And a little bit of the humor and up here is that one of our staff people, Dr. McQuay, is in labor.
Oh.
And, so we'll we'll probably get an update maybe by the end of the hearing. Today we have Senator Saltzman and Senate File 2716, and this was heard here some time ago, and then it was sent to state and local government, and then it came back to the Finance Committee. So, Senator Saltzman, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have, maybe if you want to make some comments, and then if you'd like to have Mr. Nauman go through the proposal. This is the charter school proposal that relates to the facilities, and turn it over to you, Senator Saltzman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And perhaps before I get started, I would like Mr. Nauman just to go through the papers that you have in your packet, and then I'd like to make a few brief remarks about what has happened between the last time we heard this bill and also today. And then we do have a delete all amendment, and I know that usually that's, you know, you just have one chance to do that, but it seemed easier to be able to show you the changes that we've made than to have a line-by-line amendment. So you can see it. It's a fairly technical bill. So, Mr. Nauman, if you wouldn't mind going through some of the papers that we have in front of us, that would be helpful.
Before Mr. Nauman does that, let the record reflect that there is a quorum. Mr. Nauman.
So, Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to work off the order that to show up in my packet. I know that we passed them out at the last minute, so they may not fall in the same order. There's a whole collection of documents. The first I have is the agenda. That's fairly straightforward. Dr. McQuay, before she went to the hospital, finished up the charter school provisions language summary. We thank her for that because that meant that Anne-Marie and I didn't have to do it. Then last night we put together a spreadsheet tracking. This is a legal size document that shows how the dollars flow under the A18 amendment. The next document I have is, because this committee considered the last time it was here the A5 amendment, we have a document that shows the differences that have occurred in sort of a quick summary format, and we can go through this, members, if you like, the A18 versus the A5 differences, and it just sort of quickly highlights those things that are different. There's been some conversation about charter schools that are affected by the 2003 legislative decision to create a grandfather provision on the charter school building lease aid. Some charter schools are above the 1,200, bless you, Senator, cap. And so we've asked the department to pull together a data run so that we can see how much aid per student each charter school is getting, and it's rank ordered by cap. So you can see those at the front are the ones that are the grandfathered charters. Then, subsequent to the last time the bill was here, a fiscal note was performed, and that's in the packet. And we're going to tell you at the appropriate time why the savings in that are actually now netting out to zero. And that'll be an appropriate time for that. Then I think Senator Saltzman has a document, Charter School Facilities Finance Reform, with a series of boxes and circles and arrows, and I think she wants to work through that. That's the last document I have, except for the A18 amendment, I think is the primary language.
Thank you very much.
Senator Saltzman.
What I'd like to do is just give you a brief overview of what's happened in the last month, because when this bill first came to you as the A5 amendment, there were a number of questions that were raised. We acknowledged that. It was an opportunity for us to put this idea forward as a new model for how we fund our charter school facilities in the state. And as we all know, we've been a leader in that area, and to be a leader again in how we fund facilities. We also know that there has been some questions raised by the public. We also know that our charter school working group really wanted to look at some ways where we could make sure that public dollars invested in charter school facilities stayed with the public so that they became assets of the state potentially. We also heard about how can we do this so that potentially that these bonds are at a lower interest rate. So we've worked with a number of stakeholders. I want to thank the charter school community for working with us. I want to thank the Department of Management and Budget, and you know, Commissioner Kathy Cardell for being very helpful. I also want to thank the investment community that has worked with us to help us understand something that we don't typically deal with in this committee. So we've had a number of meetings between now and then. We've also worked with the House to include them and talk to them about, you know, their concerns and their issues as well. So there's been a lot of work done, but it's a technical bill. It's 31 pages, so I'd like you to all to pull out the charter school facilities finance reform. And this is a flow chart, and I think it will give you a good overview before Mr. Nauman goes through the bill, so you have sort of a 30,000-foot perspective of what we're trying to do here. You'll notice in the top left, building leasing, and this is how we fund charter school facilities now. Whether you have an affiliated building company, whether you are working with a private financing firm, whether you are leasing, a charter school receives building lease aid. We will continue to provide lease aid under this new model. However, not all schools will get lease aid. The formula will stay the same, except the grandfather amount, which was set in 2003, will sunset in June 30th of 2011, and so that all charter schools will have access to the same dollars. In the future, a lease with an affiliated building company will not be allowed, permitted, although we're going to talk about that next. In the past, schools have been able to apply for lease aid, and it's been pretty much a check off the box and you get lease aid. We now have some other information that we will require, and some of that came from some of the testimony we had from the fire marshal, and again, making sure that these facilities are ready and, you know, appropriate for schools before lease aid is approved. And then the commissioner also has greater authority to deny lease aid, but that would be based on information not being provided. If we did not have affiliated building companies now, it would be a lot cleaner bill. Because we would move right to this facilities aid. But because we have a number of schools who have affiliated building companies right now, you see this box to the right, the building lease transition aid. But I'm going to go, first of all, drop down to the facilities aid. Because in the future, if a school wants to purchase a building and renovate it, or perhaps construct a new building, they would be able to now apply to a charter school facilities authority. And this authority is modeled after our higher education facility. We have talked about this in our last review of this bill. And that instead of going through a public entity, a city, a township, in order to secure the tax-free bonds, schools will be able to go to this authority, and there will be a process that they will apply to. And schools that are endorsed would then be able to use a credit enhancement fund, which would help to lower the interest rates for these schools. Once the bonds are paid off, then schools would receive a $400 per pupil deferred capital and maintenance cost amount, so to be able to support improvements to the buildings and also maintenance. So that would be very clean if we were just moving in that direction. But we have a number of schools right now that are that have affiliated building companies. And so those schools would be able to now get building lease transition aid. And that's the box to the upper right. The formula is similar to lease aid. The grandfather continues until a school converts to the facilities age, which we know may depend on different schools when their call dates are. It's not something that they may be able to do automatically. Schools with affiliated building companies are named in the legislation, so very specifically named, because they will no longer be able to get lease aid. They may continue to lease from their affiliated building company and receive the building lease transition aid. And ownership of their building must be transferred to the school after the financing matures. So this is where we can look at when public dollars have been used to purchase a building, it will then convert to the charter school. And should that charter school ever close, those assets would then revert to the state. Schools must provide information to to the department in order to retain this aid. So again, there's some reporting involved. In the bottom right is the credit is the charter school facilities credit enhancement account, and this is something that we talked about earlier, and this is modeled after some other states. Again, as we talked about, how can we lower the cost of interest on these bonds? Having some sort of credit enhancement fund is very important to that, so that if there was a default, that there would be a fund to help pay for those loans. What's important to note here that there's been a change since we last, you know, talked about this bill is that the Charter School Facilities Authority will have greater discretion. It's not an issue where you check off the box and you're automatically approved. That the authority would be able to collect information, and also depending on the interest rates that an affiliated building company may already have, if they may, it may be better to keep the current financing. They will be able to do that. At the same time, if the fund it does have a cap on it. If there wasn't enough funds in the account, that a school may not be able to access these dollars. So I'd like Mr. Nauman to go through. So this is sort of a broad overview of these different pots of dollars. The building lease transition aid is, again, there to help during the transition process. It is a technical bill, but I hope we can just get through it and maybe just ask some technical questions because it is a fairly lengthy bill. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Salzman. Senator Salzman, would you like to move the A18 amendment?
Yes, I would like to move the A18 amendment, and then I think we also have an A19 that has a couple other just small technical changes in it, so that we could review those as well, Mr. Chair.
Senator,
so I'd like to move
Salzman
the A18.
Moves the A18 amendment, and that's the delete all amendment that you have before you. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Salzman also moves the A20 amendment, which is the technical additions. As you can see, it'll be handed out, or is handed out. Questions that members have on the A20 amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Okay, Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman and members, perhaps a question for the author first. There's also the spreadsheet tracking sheet. Is there value in going through that prior to the language?
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'll work through that quickly. I think because it kind of relates a little more tightly to the discussion that you just had of the boxes, at least there's some ability to see the flow of the dollars. So this is the legal size document, members, similar to what we've put out in the past in a much larger format. It shows across the columns the February forecast calculations for the relevant accounts. Then it shows the A18, as modified by the A20 amendment, appropriation calculations. The accounts shown are the charter school building lease aid, what will become a new charter school facilities aid, a charter school building transition aid, charter school startup, because that's part of the conversation, a credit enhancement account for the 6% contributions, credit enhancement account for the initial capitalization, and then some administrative funding for the Department of Education and the Department of Management and Budget. So the February forecast columns, I think I'll skip over and then move quickly to the A18 2010-2011 calculation. And you can see that in fiscal 11, what's happening relative to the February forecast is that the charter school building lease aid appropriation is going down by about $9.2 million, and that those dollars are being added into the building lease transition aid. These are charter schools that are named in the bill. And then convert from the building lease pot that Senator Salzman mentioned earlier, and then transition over to the transition aid. So the net relative to the bottom line is zero. The amounts just go from one to the other. And that happens again in fiscal 12 and 13, or I should say it continues to happen in 12 and 13, where charter schools that have been transition to transition, show up on line three as opposed to line one. The dollars end up being the same. But in addition, charter schools that have, and the department made some assumptions in their fiscal note about which, about charter schools that would begin being eligible for facilities aid. And you can see that there begin to be appropriations of 628 and 1068. So that in next year's session, if this were law, we would begin showing appropriations for the facilities aid at that time. I'll skip over the startup for, well, no, it's probably worth going through that first. To pay for the initial capitalization on line six of the credit enhancement account, a recommendation was came from the administration that we cap the charter school startup at 1 year. So then the second year, the dollars that were in the forecast for the second year would be reallocated to to the credit enhancement account, and that happens in fiscal 12. Then in 13, the charter school startup aid is eliminated, and all the dollars get moved over into the initial capitalization, which provides the resources of $866,000 for initial capitalization in the credit enhancement account. On line six, you can see that there is actually, I've got those titles reversed. I apologize. So really, the title for line six should be the title for line five, if that makes sense. So the 6% contributions as a result of those charters that are beginning to move onto the facilities and buy their own building is in $45,000 and $77,000 in fiscals 12 and 13. The fiscal note, you'll see when we get to it, has the Department of Education requesting a small appropriation for the work associated with the vacant building inventory of $8,000 that's carried, and the Department of Management and Budget, which carries the administrative responsibility for the authority, needs about $392,000 for the startup of the authority and then an ongoing $147,000 each year. So those dollars are shown here. So the net to the bottom line relative to the February forecast is primarily the administrative costs of $400,000 in fiscal 11 and then dropping to $302,000 in fiscal year 12 and 13. So that's the fiscal tracking of the
Senator Hand.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nauman. Run by us again. What's happening with the charter school startup? Why is it being eliminated, and what's the rationale for that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hand, I think the thinking on this was that the charter schools have reached a bit of a plateau in terms of starting up in recent years. Also, because we're looking at a more fundamental way of financing charter schools to provide, there's a desire to create a pot of dollars in the credit enhancement account. It was felt that it was important to have some capitalization in that account. And so in fiscal 12, the second year of a charter school startup, members will recall that you get startup aid for 2 years. In your first two years, there's also federal aid that comes with that. So it's not as if they have no startup by taking that away. That provided a pot of dollars to create some capitalization for the account. So the second year in fiscal 12 was recaptured, and then the first and second year was recaptured in fiscal 13 and allocated to the credit enhancement account.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Nauman, this credit enhancement account, and the rationale is to create this fund to protect against defaults on, I guess, the bonds and so forth. In the course of the history of the charter schools and the method they're currently using to build buildings, has there been any history of defaults on bonds that would lead us to suspect that we would need to do this?
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, as we've talked about the first in the first committee meeting, I should answer your question directly. I think that that there's probably administrative folks in the office in the room that can speak more directly to the history of defaults of charter schools. But the rationale for having a credit enhancement account is to reduce the risk of the bonds. So there's a pool of dollars that bondholders can look to, or prospective purchasers of bonds can look to and say, ah, this provides additional security because there are funds there in the event that a charter school is unable to make a payment, and there is a process whereby the state will pull dollars out of that account and make the payment on behalf of charter schools that run into an unforeseen circumstance. It's an insurance pool.
Senator Salzman.
Just a brief response on this point, Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, is that it's not that it's our concern, it's the investment community's concern, that whenever you issue these bonds, having this pool will help to lower the interest rates for these schools, because right now they don't have anything to back them up. And so overall, this will lower the cost of these bonds. So it's not so much that we have seen a problem, it's to provide comfort to the investment community. And this is what we have seen has been structured in other states to provide the lower rated bonds to these schools.
Senator Hand.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Salzman, thank you. I appreciate that. I guess the concern I'm raising is I don't know if there's been a lot of investor discomfort in the current structure that I guess would remain. We could probably get some testimony on that. But I do think that reducing so dramatically the charter school startup aid is a huge signal to the charter school movement that we're not perhaps as willing to encourage additional charter schools to start operating. And it seems like that there's a trade-off here, saying that we're going to create this fund that is going to provide comfort to investors, although I'm not so sure we can guarantee if we put this into place in law that it can't be used to solve a budget problem in the future or anything else that the legislature decides to do. But we're doing that, I think, at the expense of perhaps sending a negative signal to the charter school movement as a whole that we're not so willing to have new charter schools. I'm concerned about that, but we can continue the discussion.
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the comments by Senator Hand. I was impressed with the structure, with the credit enhancement account and the initial capitalization. I, too, had questions, though, about the startup aid, because it seems to me that we don't allow charter schools to purchase a building until they've been in existence for a certain amount of years, unless that's been changed. And so we actually have a structure in law that says they should rent for so many years, but then we're quickly taking their startup money away to put it in an account that allows them to purchase, which they really can't take an advantage of till they've been successful over time. And so the very things that would give them the kind of cushion to build up and be successful, we now don't allow them to take advantage of. So I'm concerned, too, about the quick.
So, Mr. Chairman, unless you have other questions on the tracking, of course, we can come back to it if that becomes important in the future discussion. I thought I would begin going through the A18 amendment, and I'll try to blaze past some of the stuff that we've already seen and then try to spend a little bit more time on items that are new in this draft. So members will recall that the Affiliated Nonprofit Building Corporation language is repealed in the draft. That continues to be the case. So on line 119 and 1 through 1.20, there's a definition of affidavit that's related to the ABCs that is repealed. Or stricken. On page 2, there is new language that prohibits single-purpose sponsors from serving on the members, employees, or contractors of a single-purpose sponsor from serving as a contractor, board member, or employee of a charter school. Mr. Chair and members, skipping now to Section 2, there's language throughout the bill that eliminates the cooperative reference. This was language originally put into the charter school law related that allowed a charter school to form under Chapter 308A. There have been no charter schools that have done so, and so this is a matter of housekeeping to clean that up. So we'll see that in a number of places.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, on page 2 where you were talking about the sponsors, I thought we changed sponsors to authorizers. Is there a reason we're still using both those terms?
Mr. Chair and Senator, that's a good question.
On line 211 and down on 216.
You've caught me a little short, Senator Olson. I believe you're correct, but I think we want to think about that one. Yeah, this is language that was added last session. It may have been just that we were so used to using the word sponsor that we defaulted to that when that was created last year, and this was not picked up. That's a good question, if you'll let us come back to you on it.
Mr. Nauman?
So, Mr. Chair and members, on page 5, there's that language 308 again that is stricken. Moving on to page 7, there's language. This is language from the governor's bill that requires commissioner approval for charter schools to merge and creates an evaluation based on a series of criteria that the department must do. There was some circumstances during the interim where the agency ran into some challenges associated with charter schools that were merging. We didn't have language to that effect, and so in a sense it required a charter school to close and then two charter schools to close and then form a new one, which seemed a little bit cumbersome, so the governor recommended some changes, and that language is picked up here. Moving on to the next section, Section 3, is the conflict of interest section. It expands on lines 8.2 through 8.4, expands the definition, adding contracting with a for-profit entity or an individual to expand that definition to catch all possible circumstances. Down on lines 26 through 31, prohibits a charter school board member from receiving remuneration in conjunction with a financial transaction. That was in the previous draft, but some of the language has been expanded a little bit. At the top of page 10, again, the definition of the Chapter 308 reference is stricken. On lines 11.23 through 11.26 requires charter schools that are going through the endorsement process. We've talked about that term in the past, but at members' pleasure, I'll reference that again. To comply with the review and comment process that is similar for school districts that have to go through that review and comment process. The threshold for review and comment, as members will recall, last year was set at $1.4 million for school districts, so that language is, or that threshold is picked up here as an identical number for charter schools. So, Mr. Chairman and members, Section 6 of the bill amends Section 124D10, Subdivision 17. There's a collection of things that are happening here. In paragraph A, a charter school is now prohibited from leasing space from an organization whose primary purpose is to provide a facility and, so it's a sort of a twofold test, has either financed the acquisition of a building through rent off of lease aid, or is maintaining the facility off of rent. So that's a twofold test. It used to be an either-or circumstance, and now it's been changed to an and, so both have to be present.
Senator Bonham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I wasn't sure if you wanted us to ask our questions as we go through or come back, but then I thought if we get so much farther back, it perhaps would be easier to as we go. So
I think that's right.
Thank you. So with regard to the review and comment number, just
one question I would have with regard to that is when a district is going to spend 1.4, that's in relation to having assets that are pretty large, versus if we take a charter school that is only a, you know, one particular building, and so that represents so much more of their total capacity. Is it appropriate to have those two numbers mirror each other, or from a relative perspective, should the review and comment be smaller?
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonoff, I think some would argue that it should be bigger. I think the argument can go both ways. I think what was it's important to remember that the review and comment process applies to an individual project. So even though school districts may have four or five different buildings, they review and comment based on a project. And so it also administratively, it made sense to have an equal treatment of charters and districts with respect to individual projects. So the recommendations that we got from the agency was to try to be consistent if we could.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nauman. The language that we just were talking about, 1134 down through 12.5, it talks about school may not lease space from an organization that is in business to lease space to charter schools uses the rent monies from the lease to finance what they're doing. I'm a little concerned about the language. It seems to me that would effectively prohibit anybody from leasing a building to a charter school. I'm trying to. What is the intent we're trying to get at here? Because if I'm in the business of leasing buildings to people, certainly I'm going to finance that through the rents. And that's the business.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, what I can walk you through is the technical aspect of this. It's we've gone around and around a collection of times on this to make sure that we are saying what is intended. The first test, and remember, both have to be present. It's sort of it's kind of a confusing way to write this, but the primary purpose of an organization proposing to lease a building or land to the charter school is to provide a facility for the charter school. You would commonly think of that as the ABC circumstance. But it has been suggested that if that were the only test, you'd have a circumstance where the building corporations sometimes create separate corporations for the purposes of leasing. So that might create it might be too broad of a net, if you will. Secondly, the organization also has to have one or two of the following circumstance. The organization has financed the acquisition of a facility through rent paid by a charter school from building lease aid, or the organization is maintaining the school facility on behalf of the charter school through rent paid by. So it's got to be the first piece and one of the other two.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Thomas, so just what kind of organization would likely qualify to provide a leased building to a charter school under this law? What is the structure we're envisioning would occur under this structure? That's what I'm unclear about. I'm not sure that this allows anybody to do it.
Senator Salzman.
Perhaps, Mr. Chair, I could kind of just sort of interject what my intent was here, is that we like to close loopholes we've made it very clear that affiliated building companies will not be eligible for lease aid. They need to be in this transition pool. But we've never really defined what is an affiliated building company. And so an organization that organizes specifically to provide facilities to a charter school, as opposed to a private developer who develops, their intent is to develop real estate. It's not necessarily technically to serve charter schools, but an affiliated building company right now organizes specifically, and their purpose is to provide facilities for a charter school. And so this is to make it very clear, to kind of close that loophole, that right now there's a few schools that the department has identified as being in a gray area. Well, they're not calling themselves an affiliated building company, but they're sure set up to look exactly like an affiliated building company. They're just not calling themselves that. So the idea here is that obviously, schools that receive lease aid are leasing from, you know, private property owners. So there wouldn't be any problem with that. It's that there's a threshold here that if you're developing specifically that your purpose is to provide facilities for charter schools, and these dollars are being used to finance that, the department would be able to deny lease aid in those situations.
Senator Hand.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Saltzman, and I appreciate that the intent is to try to deny the current structure from continuing, and I'm not in the property management business, but I'm trying to envision what kind of organization would qualify under this, because commercial property managers, they build buildings for office spaces, for example, and they design the buildings to be office spaces, and they market them as office spaces, and they finance them through the rents paid by people who rent the office spaces. So if you're in a business of property development and you decide you're going to provide school buildings, you wouldn't qualify under this. So are we asking property developers to say, well, we're building office space, but we're going to lease it to a school as a school? I just am not sure that if you do this language, anybody would qualify as a organization that could legally lease to a charter school. And there's another way to write it. But
Senator Hand, if we could just hold your thought for just a second, and if we could do Clause B and C, get just that section, and then we'll come back. And there's a couple other questions I think that members have on that. Mr. Nolan?
Mr. Chairman and members, paragraph B allows a school district and a charter school to use the data of a charter school for determining adequate yearly progress. Both are, if it's advantageous for both to do so, that can be done, and request the agency to request a waiver for that purpose. Paragraph C relates more directly to this point that Senator Han was raising. Because there are now essentially three buckets in which a charter school could receive aid from, paragraph C directly relates to those charter schools that fall into that transition circumstance. And that language, members, is pretty identical to what we had before for all of lease aid. So a charter school that's transitioned in the bill and is receiving transition aid can continue to lease from an affiliated building corporation or whoever they were leasing from before. That creates the seamless transition, if you will. And I think that it's important to keep both of those paragraphs in the back of your head as you think about how the structure works. So moving forward, if a charter school is receiving lease aid, that restriction applies. But if a charter school is in transition, and there are a collection of charter schools that would be affected by that language, and the author did not want to deleteriously affect those charters, so paragraph C was added and made applicable to those charter schools for that purpose.
So, Senator Hand, does that kind of fill in the gap that you were?
Well, Mr. Chairman, not entirely, because I'm envisioning paragraph A to be the prospective structure going forward at post-transition, and I'm not clear if anybody would qualify under that language to provide a building to a charter school.
Okay. Senator, let's see here. Senator Roebling and then Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to put this in a real-life perspective to see how this would work. I have one charter school in my district, and it was the classrooms were built attached to a church facility that they are leasing from. But the church has apparently a long-term contract with the charter school because they built these extra classrooms on. They had some classrooms. They had a gym. They had some things they could use. Now, if they want to expand, and that is their goal, to expand in the future, would they, under this, be able to do that? Because I don't know that at the end the church would want that to be a publicly owned facility. So what kind of a fix are they in? Could they expand at that site, or can they even continue doing what they're doing I'm really confused.
Okay. Senator Salzman?
I guess I'd ask Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, is the primary purpose of the church to provide a facility for charter schools? Is that their primary purpose?
Mr. Chair, no, they started out as providing religious services.
So I guess I would perhaps, Mr. Chair, then say that if that, you know, in my mind, that would not be a primary purpose. An organization that is organized with their primary purpose to provide facilities for charter schools, that would be sort of the threshold. And this is an area where we have worked on this language for probably the last month, trying to find the language that, you know, it's trying to, I think, satisfy the fact is we don't want another loophole here. We've had a loophole. And we're trying to avoid future loopholes. So that's the intent. Now, and perhaps it's that there's an issue of profit versus nonprofit. But we're trying to, or at least I'm trying to avoid a similar situation in the future.
Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Senator Salzman, what happens, though, if they want to expand on that site? Because they're doubling, they're increasing their enrollment, and they want to double their classrooms. Now they only have, one classroom per grade, but they're going to go to two, and they're going to have to add some more. If they do that under the new rule, under the new law, and that would that then have to, at the end of the lease period or the contract period, have to become publicly owned property?
Senator Salzman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, I don't see that as a conflict. I don't see that as an issue, that they would have to go through the authority, because the charter school itself is not doing the construction, correct? The church is?
Right.
Yeah.
Chairman?
Senator Bonhoeff and then Senator Olson.
I want to speak in support of the language as it stands. And Senator Roebling, I think there's no problem in the example you cited, because the church is not there for the purpose of being a charter school. It's there for being a church. And just going back to why this language is in the bill is that we have an objective to stop having affiliated building corporations. And so what this language does is it says if you're going to start a school just for the purpose of making a profit on that building, you can't do that anymore. And if you've done that in the past, that's how we structured everything. And so there's a transition, and nobody is being forced out of their current arrangements. We're just saying in the future. And so to the question Senator Hand raised about who would qualify, well, Welsh companies and Toll and Brookfield Properties and any other company that's in the business of commercial real estate that chose to use that for a church. We're just saying that if you are in the business of creating charter schools, that's not what we're looking for. We want charter schools to be an educational experience, not a business venture. And if you are going to be in the business of that, then you're a business manager. You're not going to create assets doing that. Those are state assets. They're state dollars. And so I feel very strongly that we don't want our state tax dollars going towards building assets for those who are making money on them.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, to Senator Roebling's illustration, there's protection in the structure that you created for any default, but if the school would close and it's on church property, then you mentioned that there's some concern about would the public then own the facility on a church property?
The lease.
Or how does that work?
Mr. Nolan?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I think that I would think about that as if it continues to be a lease and it's not an asset of the charter school, then that section would not apply.
So it's not it wouldn't be owned that?
I believe, Senator Olson, that the example that Senator Roebling structured in her question was one that allows it, because it's not, the church is not a primary. Its primary purpose is not to provide a charter school. It's to be a religious organization. So they would continue to receive lease aid. They would continue to lease to the charter school under that example. And if the charter school failed for any reason, the buildings in which the charter school was operating is not an asset of the charter school, so it would not be a public asset.
So Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, if they were expanding, then they wouldn't be using the parts of this law to bond and acquire the bonds to add that space because they're leasing. It's the church that's building the church would add the expansion, and then they would continue to lease from it.
Yes.
Senator Roebling?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, yes, the church is actually putting up the money right up front to build the classrooms. But when I read this paragraph A, it gave me great concern that they fit both of those descriptions as far as I could figure out. So I'm thinking, well, they're precluded even from doing it. But then when I get to paragraph C, it talks about nonprofit, non-sectarian organizations, private property owners.
And sectarian.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm hoping that that cancels out what I seem to be reading in paragraph A, that it would leave that facility do what it's doing.
Senator Hand.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and to Senator Bonhoeff, I just want to try to get clear on this, because in the traditional public school structure, there are organizations, there are companies that specialize in building school buildings and architectural firms that specialize in designing school buildings. And if we have a charter school program and we are going to encourage charter schools to lease buildings, they're going to want to have buildings that will fit their purpose. And so you're going to have organizations designing school buildings for lease to charter schools. And as I read the language, I'd say, well, if they do that, they can't be eligible to do it. And so you have to design the building for some other purpose and then lease it as a school building. This is the way I read that.
Senator Salzman.
You know, I think that there is an underlying policy in this bill, and that is that should we be always building new buildings? Should charter schools, I mean, within our own communities, I know in the Stillwater District, we need a new early childhood center. And the initial thing was, well, let's build one. And then it was like, we have so many empty commercial buildings now, or we have so many areas that maybe we should look at renovating. There's been the discussion of when we have empty school buildings, how should we respond? And so I think that in some of this, you'll see as we go through, there is an incentive to how can we use existing space. So I think we're getting caught up a little bit here in always new. And I think the public is saying to us, we can buy a used building for far less than building a new one. And so I think in some of this, it's the incentive would be of how can we renovate. You know, we give an incentive to schools. You can do that earlier than, you know, constructing a new facility. So some of that is in here as well of how do we use existing buildings and make sure that those existing buildings that we have incentives, that they're high quality, that it's not just a corner of an old warehouse, but that we want to make sure that they have the ability to, renovate space.
Okay. Members, I would like to get to go through the bill and get to the testimony, because if by chance we don't finish, I'd like to at least have taken the testimony. So a couple more questions, and then maybe we can continue to move on. Senator Bonner?
Mr. Chair, and just to respond to Senator Hand, and then I'll move on. Senator Hand, when Morton Construction or Morton Center or anybody else designs and builds a public school, they don't lease it to the school district. They build it, they design it, and it's a state asset. So I don't think we're talking apples to apples here. I think people should design wonderful charter schools, and they should do that. And then now we have a structure where the charter school can use this new system to bond for paying for it.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonhoeff, the reason they don't, the charter schools are prohibited from owning buildings. Are they not?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, that's what this now creates, a structure for them to own, and that's why it's in there that way. We're changing.
Okay. I think we'll move on.
But, you know, we did talk about paragraph B, which is a really different paragraph.
Let's wait till testimony.
Okay.
I'm sure the people who are going to testify are taking close note and probably will bring up these points too. Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman and members, on page 13, line 13 is an exciting provision that also eliminates chapter 308A. And the same applies on 14.6. Senator Salzman made reference earlier to vacant buildings. Along that vein, Section 9 requires the Department of Administration and Education to publish a list of unused vacant buildings and requires school districts to comply with reasonable requests from the Department of Education for information. Mr. Chairman and members, based on how the statutes fall, we're going to kind of go in a little bit of reverse order, but bear with me for a moment. Section 10 creates a general ed subtraction that effectively creates the cap for a charter school that is endorsed. So if a charter school has gone through the authority process and is endorsed and is purchasing a building, there is a subtraction off of general education equal to their effective cap. And the reason for that is that on the facilities aid side of things, they're going to be receiving 100% of their principal and interest. So by creating a cap subtraction and a full funding of their principal and interest, their debt service effectively, what you're left with that's not subtracted is the amount that essentially that 16% that's implied of a cross-subsidy that would be existent in the way the language is structured before. The reason this was rejiggered as a different structure was the bond community felt that it was important to be able to point to the law and say, under those circumstances where a charter school is endorsed and is receiving aid to pay the bonds, previously it was structured in an amount that showed that it was 84%, and it was felt that that was a little bit confusing to the bond community. They wanted to see that 100% of the dollars is, in fact, there. It was before and it is now, but there is an implied cross-subsidization of their general ed dollars. So it was felt that with some assistance from Dr. Melcher that this was a preferred structure that allowed the bond community to see 100% of the dollars in facilities aid to pay off the debt service, and we end up in the same place. But there's a couple of statutes that work together on this, and if there's confusion about that, we can certainly have Dr. Melcher give us some assistance because he gave me some. So, Mr. Chairman and members, if a charter school is endorsed and is paying off bonds, it under Section 11, it's required to reserve $100 per pupil unit of its operating capital for repairs and replacement. That's paragraph B. If it's not endorsed, there is the old language still applies. Mr. Chairman and members, Senator Salzman spoke in that box conversation about some additional requirements on lease aid information that was going to be required. You can see that in Section 12 under lines 17 through 24. It adds things. We've seen this in the earlier draft. It hasn't changed dramatically. The owner of the building, the leasers, current members and principals, et cetera, through a whole list of items. Paragraph B clarifies that the commissioner may deny lease aid in the absence of information or if the charter school is leasing from the language that we just spent a fair bit of time talking about. So if that test applies, the commissioner is allowed to deny. Paragraph D is the formula for lease aid, and members will note that the formula is largely unchanged for those charters that are under the $1,200 cap. A charter school that is over the cap will be grandfathered until June 30th of 2011. So it extends the grandfather for one more year.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
To clarify, Mr. Mueller, I think you said that they would be allowed to deny, but it says on 1628 that they must deny.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Are you missing something?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, no, you're not. The commissioner, if I spoke it that way, that I should emphasize the point that the language does require that. And I'll say that it's been a long time since Mr. Mueller was in this committee, but I'm glad that he's remembered. Mr. Chairman and members, Section 13 provides is the language of the facilities aid. So this is the aid that accrues to a charter school that has been endorsed, is purchasing a building, and is paying off their debt service. And this is the section that works sort of hand in glove with the earlier gen ed subtraction section. You'll note that on line 21, that a charter school is eligible to receive facilities aid equal to an amount needed to meet when due the principal and interest payment obligations. So they're getting 100% in that section. So in order to create the subtraction, we have to work it with the general education aid portion. So that's how those work. Previously, we would have had this as a percentage of their principal and interest, and that's how the A5 amendment was drafted. This one, I think, allows the bond community to see that 100% of the aid is there so that it gives them comfort on the risk side of things. Mr. Chairman and members, the lines 25 and 27 requires the aid to be actually used on the loan payments, clarifying language to make sure that they don't receive the aid and use it on something else. Senator Salzman mentioned earlier that once a bonds are paid off, that a charter school can receive up to $400 per kid for maintenance costs and requires the revenue to be used for that purpose. That's paragraph B. Mr. Chairman and members, Section 14 is the credit enhancement language. Paragraph A creates the account. Paragraph B deposits 6% of all charters' P&I into the account and says that funds in the account are for the benefit of all charter schools. That's a clarifying language that we had some ambiguity on before. Paragraph C allows the account to receive grants and gifts, but that the grants and gifts would accrue to all charter schools. So in other words, you can't put money into the account and say, I really like this charter school. It's to help their bonds. It's to the benefit of all charter schools. Section 15 requires the commissioner to be notified if a charter school intends to sell or transfer its property, and the sales must be at appraised market value. Section 16 is the building lease transition aid. And this is the section that paragraph A allows a charter school to apply for building lease transition aid. The lines 8 through 21, actually through 27, set the requirements of information that a charter school must provide to receive the BLT aid. Lines 22 through 27 is new. This is language that requires, and essentially these are the charter schools that are receiving this aid that have an ABC corporation. And it was felt that it was important to say that if a charter school remains in transition, for example, and the bonds are paid off, that once the bonds are paid off, that because state resources were used, that there must be an agreement that the facility will transfer to the charter school from the ABC at least by the maturity date of the bonds. And that's point 9, lines 22 through 27. There's that similar language, Senator Olson, that you flagged me on earlier, that requires the commissioner, if the information is not provided, that the commissioner may deny aid. Then the transition aid is not to be used for custodial maintenance, utility, or other operating costs. And then beginning on line 35 is the formula for the BLT aid. And that's very similar to what we saw in the lease aid before. It's 90% of approved costs, or $1,200 per pupil unit. And on line 20.3, the grandfather provisions continue under this pot of dollars for a charter that's in that pot until as long as they're in that pot. So if they convert to facilities aid and they go through the authority process, they will have to live with a lower cap if they were a grandfather charter before.
Senator Bonhoeffer.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Nauman, could there be a situation with a charter school who's in the transition program where the what we have on 19.22 and 19.27, that subdivision 9, could that be in conflict with a contract they already had with their building corporation such that we could have a problem there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonner, maybe you can say a little bit more about what you're thinking. The language requires to be done by the maturity date. For example, if the financing mechanism includes bonds that go until, say, 2025 or something like that, when the bonds finally mature or when they're finally paid off, there's a requirement that the building then be transferred to the charter school as opposed to staying with the building corporation.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nauman, that's what I'm wondering, because if the building corporation was in existence just to be in the business of making money off the charter school, will that always be the situation where that was the arrangement that was struck versus the bonds are paid off and they have the ability to do something different with it?
Senator Salzman.
On that point, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoeffer, I guess that if an affiliated building company was set up and that for some reason the school was going to revert to another organization or whatever, they could continue to do that. They just wouldn't be able to get the transition aid to pay for the school. So in other words, there's sort of a safety mechanism here that if we're going to, again, use state dollars to pay off, you know, the loans on these buildings, then it should revert to a public asset at the end. And it would be difficult to do that in the middle of this, because that's the problem we're having, is that if we could just, you know, take these loan and these bonds and say we're going to transfer the ownership to the charter school, we probably can't do that. So we have to wait until it is owned by the corporation. And so there's an agreement. If you want these dollars, these are the rules you need to play by.
Mr. Nolan.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoeffer, I guess I'd add one additional thought. By definition, we're talking about the charters that have the ABC Corporation. They're set up for that purpose, to create a building for the charter school. And many testified that the reason they did that was to buy a building. So logically, it should revert to the charter school after the conclusion of the bonds.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nolan, then by June 30th, 2011, the affiliated or associated or whatever they are, building corporations, will not be suspended if the bonds have not been yet paid off.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, no. The point there that I'll be clear on that date. The date reference there essentially means that points 1 through 8, if this were law, would be implementable on the effective date. But the June 30th requires, effectively creates a bit of a delay. The agency requested that they have a year delay to give charter schools the opportunity to, you know, pass the resolutions and begin providing the agency with that information. But certainly, even if it were effective immediately, it doesn't require the bonds to be paid off, but simply that there's a document that says that the ABC and the charter school have agreed that when the bonds mature, that the asset will transfer to the charter school at the conclusion of the bonds, whatever that date is.
Mr. Bauman?
So, Mr. Chairman and members, section 17. I think is probably relevant to that conversation that we had before. This is the use of state money statute for charters, and it allows state aid to be used to buy land and buildings by charter schools that have been endorsed. So if you have gone through the authority endorsement process and are endorsed and have been approved to take out bonds on behalf of buying a building, you're now permitted to use state resources to buy a new building or an old building for that matter. Mr. Chairman and members, I'll highlight that on line 30.28, the amendment struck chapter 308 or. That was a technical change. Mr. Chairman and members, paragraph G on page 21, line 34, returns the remaining facilities to the state in the event of a closure. And at the very bottom, the four mergers approved sentence begins the authority that allows the sale of, in the event of a closure, allows a charter school to sell a building at market value or transfer that building to either another charter school or a school district. Are there questions? No. Mr. Chairman and members, Section 19 creates the Charter School Facilities Authority, consists of 8 members, 5 appointed by the governor with Senate confirmation. All must be Minnesota residents, and 2 must be reside outside the metro area. Paragraph B defines the expertise appointees that are gubernatorial appointees. Paragraph C requires the Department of Management and Budget to administer the authority. We recall that there was an associated appropriation that will be made later. Subdivision 2 requires the president of the Minnesota School Boards Association to be a non-voting member and serve without compensation. Subdivision 3 sets the terms, compensation, removal conditions. Subdivision 4 establishes the duties, allows fees to be collected, and allows the authority to contract for some services. Subdivision 5 begins the conditions under which a charter school may apply for endorsement. So if you are a charter school that is 5 years or older, you may seek endorsement to purchase an existing building. You seek endorsement for that purpose. And then there are paragraphs 1 through 9 set the information that's required to be given to the authority. I think the addition is that the positive review and comment language is new since we saw it in the A5 amendment. That's on lines 35 and 36. Then that language is essentially mirrored for a charter school that's 8 years or older or more. They can seek endorsement for the purposes of constructing a facility, not just purchasing one. So you've got to be 8 years old for that purpose. And then the language effectively mirrors the previous language.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we pass by this, I just want to go back to page 22, section 19, subdivision B, which is 2224 to 2226. The requirement that the president of the school board, Minnesota School Board Association, or designee shall serve as an advisory non-voting member of the board. And Senator Salzman, just what are we doing here with this?
Very good.
Senator Salzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hand, you know, one of the things that we've talked a lot about is that in Minnesota, we really have a very confrontational relationship between our charter schools and our district schools. I think we've all acknowledged that. And part of what our working group talked about, part of what we did in last year's legislation, was to have of where do we get back to the fact that we have a strong public school system, and charter schools and district schools are all public schools. And throughout here, and this is where I think we've tried to look at how do we begin to learn from each other, how do we begin to see ourselves, how do we begin to have those kind of relationships. And so we modeled this after the Higher Education Facilities Authority. And on that authority, a member of the private schools sits as a non-voting member of that. And so I think that that's important, that there is a voice. Now, they're not a voting member, but I think if we're going to talk about how do we begin to have a constructive conversation about our vacant buildings, how we start to have these kind of conversations, to say you don't belong at the table when we make these decisions is, I think, maybe even making a more divisive relationship. So it seemed to me that we have put together an authority here that represents expertise, that represents the interests. But I think it's important to have the school board, and, you know, that seemed to be the logical place to go to. The other thing is that, you know, some charter schools, I think, belong to the School Board Association. Am I correct on that? So our School Board Association is open to all public school boards. So that was where we felt, what can we put into this bill to start that kind of dialogue? And I know that there's been a lot of criticism on this, and it's such a small little tiny step to be able to, again, bring all of our public school stakeholders together.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to just question something on 23.23. It says that one of the requirements will be that the charter school has to show that they had a net positive unreserved general fund balance as of June 30th in the preceding five fiscal years in order to be considered for this program. And, you know, I don't know, with our delayed payments and all of the things that we've been doing, and it's not their fault, how will anybody potentially make that for 5 years? I'm really concerned about number three there.
Senator Saltzman.
On that point, Senator Roebling and Mr. Chair, you know, we are trying here to look at a system that also, because there is no voter approval here, when a public school has to go out and ask their voters for dollars to build a new facility, the public gets to weigh in and look at a lot of this information. And so we're allowing charter schools to purchase buildings, to use state dollars to improve facilities, to buy facilities, to own them. And so we're trying to look here. Is there what information is critical? What's the threshold before a charter school is then considered for that? And this is after 5 years. So I can appreciate some of that, but we want to make sure that these schools are very, very stable. And that not only includes the fact how are they financially stable, but where are they at in terms of their achievement with students? Is this a charter school that we think is serving children's really well? And, you know, the charter schools, because we have given them greater flexibility, we've removed some of the mandates, they can operate differently than a district school, we may have the bar a little bit higher because there is no public voter approval here. So this is, I think, where in working with, I think, the agencies of how do we create a high bar before the authority even considers them. After 5 years, if a school is not financially stable, can we guarantee that they should be in this credit enhancement fund? Because one school that fails could really impact that fund. So, again, they can continue to lease, but in terms of before they can buy, before they can purchase a building, we want to make sure that they're a school that we believe has a bright future, is stable, is serving students well.
Senator Roblin.
But, you know, I can see looking at their books and reviewing them and making sure that they have done good financial management. But to say that at the end of the year that they have to have a fund balance, which may not be in their control at all because of delayed payments and shifts, I don't know that's fair. And I don't know if that's happening, and I'll wait and hear from the testifiers. But I've been hearing from charter schools that they are really facing some problems with the delayed payments. And so I don't know how many will have a positive fund balance on June 30th of this year.
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair and Senator Saltzman, have you considered having as part of this bill, I don't see it in here and I might be missing something, but I know you brought forward that bill with regard to the delayed payments for the school for the Metro Deaf. Would you consider having as part of this bill that unless that the we cannot
do delayed payments to charter schools unless they have a reserve fund balance of over a certain percentage, just like we do for, you know, we can't do something if a school district is in SOD.
Senator Saltzman.
On that point, Mr. Chair, and Senator Bonoff, I think I'd like the Department of Management and Budget to maybe help me on this one, because I think it's very important that in putting this bill together, we worked with the department to really look at what they were comfortable with as well. And so I don't know if you want to hear from them now, but I think that some of these things are issues that we tried to work with the investment community, we tried to work with management and budget to look at where we're protecting the state, where we're protecting this credit enhancement fund, where we're giving, you know, accessibility to schools. But those are some of the issues that we reached agreement on that were not necessarily what I wanted by myself, but where we were able to come together and find agreement.
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. We currently have a...
Dr. Melcher, if you could just move the microphone kind of right over in front of you there. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, in the past when the state has delayed payments both to school districts and charter schools, there's been a provision that enables the state to continue to pay 90% of the general education aid during the current year for school districts and charter schools that are in statutory operating debt. And as part of the governor's unallotment plan, he included the same feature in that. So currently the school districts and charter schools that are in statutory operating debt are receiving 90% of their general education aid during the current year. They're not receiving the 73%. Now with the Metro Deaf School, I know Senator Saltzman's bill went further because of some very unique circumstances that Metro Deaf was in, because they're entirely dependent on the special education tuition billing to make their cash flow. And it's really a cash flow issue as opposed to a end-of-year fund balance issue. This bill is saying if the end-of-year fund balance is negative in any of the past 5 years, then you're not eligible. And I think the idea was to make sure that the charter schools that go into this are financially stable in order to make the credit enhancement program mean something. If we have charter schools that are in debt going into the fund, there's a greater likelihood that we'll have defaults, and therefore it's unlikely that the charter schools going into the fund will be able to get any significant interest savings by going into the fund if we have a lot of schools in there that are bad credit risks. And so I think that was part of the idea here, was in order to ensure that we get some credit savings in terms of interest costs, that we wanted to make sure we had stable schools going in. But I think the cash flow issue is separate from the end-of-year fund balance issue.
Okay. Senator Hand?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure who's maybe Dr. Melcher or Mr. Nauman, but just further up the page on 23, lines 23, 16 through 19, one of the considerations is the charter school would submit evidence that reading and math separately, that there's evidence that the students making medium and high growth is equal to or greater than the percentage of students in the state making medium. So there's an academic requirement component to being approved to be eligible to get into a building. Now, when traditional school districts submit their documentation to the department for review and comment when they want to purchase or do an addition or build a new building, do they have the same requirement to show that they are also making progress before they're permitted to build their building?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, no, that is not part of the current review and comment process for school districts.
Senator Saltzman?
There, Mr. Chair, and Senator Hand, on that same point, though, but this is not only about the review and comment, it's that are we going to then give them state dollars to build a building? And a community certainly can look at its school district's achievement before it approves or votes for this. And I think this goes back to the fact of we want to make sure that, again, charter schools are successful. Do we want to replicate schools that are not showing, are not addressing the achievement gap? And so I think that that's where we've tried to look at again is if we're going to invest in permanent buildings and use state dollars and there's a sense of permanency here, is this a charter school that we want to point to and say, this is the kind of school? And I think we've had a lot of discussion about raising the bar and higher student achievement. And our charter schools are given greater flexibility because we're asking more of them in terms of student achievement. So, you know, in exchange for, you don't have to go to the voters, because there are many people who would say, would you give public schools this ability? Will you let us, you know, if we do this, this, and this, can we get dollars without voter approval to construct buildings or buy new buildings? So some trade-off.
Thank you. Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair and members, I left off on page 24, line 24, which is subdivision 6.
And I, again, would remind members that I'd like to get the testimony of the people who have come here today. So
requires the authority to make a determination for endorsement for those districts that are in transition and establish some additional criteria, including call dates and outstanding debt. This is in reference to the fact that under the A18 amendment, charters are no longer that are in transition are no longer required to make the transition to facilities aid, and it gives it a two-way street so that the authority has some evaluation of those charters as well based on call dates and simply the math of refinancing. Subdivision 7, the State and Local Government Committee added an expiration, essentially making the authority permanent. Section 20 requires the authority to approve charters for borrowing. This is prohibits the approval of bonds if they are projected to be less than 84% of principal and interest in any fiscal year. That's a way of determining if the revenue cash flow is sufficient. Subdivision 2 is simply the endorsement definition. An addition on lines 18 through 20, subdivision 3 allows the authority to requires the authority to receive a mortgage from the charter school, and that mortgage may be assigned to a trustee for the benefit of the bondholders. This was an addition recommended by the Department of Management and Budget. Subdivision 4, Senator Salzman may want to speak to, but it prohibits a charter school from using the term endorse or endorsement in promotional materials or advertising. Section 21 allows the board of a charter school with a two-thirds vote to acquire facilities and take out bonds in anticipation of state aid. Mr. Chairman and members, Section 22 permits the authority to issue revenue bonds on behalf of a charter school, and it allows the authority to enter in a loan agreement with the charter school and establish the conditions of that loan. Paragraph B permits the authority to exercise the power of a municipality for the purposes of financing buildings, and we've changed some of the language on lines 22 and 23 to reference the language of the bonding community. It requires that the bonds be competitive or negotiated, which is essentially reference to a public sale or a private sale. Either is permitted. On line 26.25, at the request of the Department of Management and Budget, the term of the bonds cannot exceed 20 years. It previously said 30. Also at the request of the Department of Management and Budget, a overall cap on the outstanding debt obligation of the authority is limited to $150 million. Subdivision 2 clarifies that the bonds are not full are not public debt, and they are not the full faith and credit of the state, and that levies may not be compelled, and that the payment of the levies are contingent upon appropriation, and that there should be conspicuous statement in the bond prospectus to that effect. Subdivision 3 is the validity statement that says that the bonds will remain valid, whether they're taxable or not, regardless of any changes made at the federal government level. Section 23 is the definition in subdivision 1, clarifies the definition of what we mean by debt obligation during this in this section. And subdivision 2 establishes the conditions and process if a charter school is unable to make the payments. This is the we're in the section now that is where if a charter school can't make a payment, what happens? How does that payment get made? And a collection of notifications have to occur. The Department of Management and Budget are given information from the charter school as required under this subdivision. It's language like, you know, who gets paid, how does the wire transfer process work? And then paragraph B requires the payment from the agency out of the charter school credit enhancement account to begin making the payments on behalf of the charter school. Paragraph C requires the Department of Management and Budget and Education to develop a procedure for notification in the event that this kind of event were to occur. Subdivision 3 requires charters to pay interest on P&I that's paid on behalf of their bond. And subdivision 4 is essentially protection for the charter school credit enhancement account. If a charter school has to utilize the charter school credit enhancement account for the purposes of paying off bonds, then an aid reduction is created. Paragraph B allows the Department of Education to extend the repayment to the charter school credit enhancement account to protect the educational program of the charter school. Subdivision 5 requires the development of a plan to assist a charter school in this circumstance. Subdivision 6 is fairly standard language that's also in the school district language that if the state bond rating is a concern, the commissioner of the Department of Management and Budget is not required to issue warrants on behalf of a charter school. I think that this widely considered this is probably unnecessary, but it does provide the Department of Management and Budget some assurances. Subdivision 7 allows the commissioner of the Department of Management and Budget to enter into agreements on disclosing information with respect to the bonds. Section 24 changes the definition of a public building to include charter schools. Section 25 is the appropriation from last year's K-12 bill for the Department of Management and Budget, adding a rider for $8,000 for the vacant buildings list. That's on line 21, page 30. The appropriation adds the Department of Management and Budget $392,000 in accordance with the fiscal note associated with startup and management costs or administrative costs associated with the authority. The base appropriation is set in fiscal 12 and later at $147,000. Mr. Chairman, Section 26 is the transition eligibility. Subdivision 1 is the list of charter schools that would be eligible for building lease transition aid. These are the lists of charters that we believe include an associated building corporation and should be listed and moved into a transition. We think we've got everybody. Subdivision 2 allows the Department of Education to do some program management associated with building lease aid and transition lease aid and facilities aid as charters are transitioning back and forth, allows them to adjust payments. Subdivision 3 borrows language from the repealed provisions of the Associated Nonprofit Building Corporation in law and just sets forth some conditions of those ABCs, who can be board members and government data practices, et cetera. Section 27 is the reduction in fiscal 12 for the second year of a charter school startup aid. Section 28 requires the Department of Management and Budget to credit the savings associated with the charter school startup aid into the charter school facilities credit enhancement account. Because we can't appropriate for fiscal 12 and 13, it's just instructive language here to tell the DMB to deposit the money there. Then section 29 is the repealers. Paragraph A is the Associated Nonprofit Building Corporation statute that's no longer necessary under the language of the bill. And paragraph B is the startup aid repealed entirely after fiscal year 2013.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nauman. What I'd like to do I have a list here of a number of people, and if we could kind of march through those and get that information out on the presented, and then if the members have questions, they can ask those toward the end. Dr. Melcher, for some comments, and then I believe also Amy Wallstein from Department of Education.
Good morning. I'm Amy Wallstein. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Department of Education. And I'll just provide a couple brief comments from the department. The department would like to thank Senator Saltzman for the considerable time and energy she's devoted to developing this legislation. The process by which the bill has been developed has been very open and transparent, beginning with the hearings that the Charter School Subcommittee held, to multiple meetings with stakeholders, including charter schools, the investment community, as well as the Department of Education and Management and Budget. Many people have provided input on the language, and Senator Saltzman has worked with all the interested parties to address concerns and find solutions. Excuse me. From the department standpoint, the legislation provides a vehicle by which charter schools can purchase facilities if they meet certain conditions, and this is a big step forward. The legislation also provides a transparent and straightforward process for lease aid and sets up a clear structure for lease aid, transitions aid, and facilities aid. It also creates the Charter Schools Facilities Authority, which has the ability to determine which schools are financially and academically in a position to develop a facility. So MDE would like to express our support for this legislation. We think it represents significant reform to Minnesota's charter school law and provides and will lead Minnesota's nation-leading charter school laws to the next level.
Thank you, Ms. Wallstein. Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just here to answer any sort of technical questions. The department appreciates the opportunity to have worked with Senator Saltzman on the development of the bill, and we appreciate that that there were a number of changes that were made in the legislation to address concerns that the department had raised.
Okay, I just want to extend the gratitude on our behalf to the department and all the help that you've given Senator Saltzman and answering questions and pointing out places that needed some improvement. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Senator Saltzman?
So just to ditto that, Mr. Chair, I really just think that the Department of Education and Management and Budget have been very, very helpful, and I appreciate that very much because this is a new frontier for us. So.
Great. Thank you. Eugene Piccolo?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Eugene Piccolo, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. First, I would like to express our appreciation for the work that Senator Saltzman and other members of the committee and staff have done in terms of this issue of charter school facilities and the commitment to work through the issues, concerns, and questions that have been raised throughout this process. Secondly, from our perspective, we believe this version has improved in many ways, but we still see it as a work in progress because there are still issues and questions that need to be refined, we believe. And so I'd like to take a few moments to walk through some of those issues and questions that we still have. And all of these are things we've already spoken to Senator Saltzman about, so it's just a matter of sharing with you. If you look on page 1112, that whole issue of nonprofits that are created for the purpose of leasing, for there are two things. One, if you look at the bottom line, listening to the earlier discussion about this, perhaps one way of addressing that issue is to say the primary legal purpose of that organization is for the purpose of, because the legal purpose of a church is religion. It is not for a charter school. So rather than just leave purpose so vague, define what, that it's a legal purpose. The one concern we do have with regard to this is that there is a national organization called the Charter School Development Corporation, which is designed to build buildings for charter schools across the country. And this would prohibit them from doing that in Minnesota. And they do have two or three buildings they have done with in the state of Minnesota. And we do have charter schools in those buildings. So this basically would say they couldn't be renting from those people. So we do have a concern about that. In terms of page 12, section B, we have spoken in opposition of that section before, and we continue to oppose it, basically because to say that one LEA can count the scores of another LEA, I think requires a waiver from the federal government, and we don't see particularly any particular purpose in this. In fact, it basically, I think, is to give an incentive to school districts to lease to charter schools, but if it's about test scores, the only schools they're going to lease to are schools that are scoring higher than the district, so most schools are not going to be able to get leasing anyway. So we pose that section.
Which section was that?
On page 12, section B.
12.7
and 12.8 through that paragraph. On page 15, it was already pointed out that the formula is kind of confusing, and first read by many of our schools, they looked at and said the greater of zero on page 1524, or the difference between, I think the explanation was helpful that was given earlier, but we would encourage that perhaps a actual chart with numbers to show it, because people are totally confused by this language. On page 16, in terms of building lease aid, we would recommend some changes in the list of required information, and we have submitted some suggestions for that. The other thing in this, it is unclear whether this is an annual list of things you have to submit, or is it once when you submit for your lease, because a lease is multiple year. And I think it needs to be clarified whether this is something we have a school has to do every year or when they're actually submitting for approval of the lease.
That's a good
suggestion. On page 17, lines 17, 11 through 13, we have a concern that those schools that are still under the $1,500 grandfather clause would only have 1 year to make an adjustment, especially when things are tight. I looked last night again at the list. We have about 10 schools that would fall under this category, and the amount of difference in lease aid ranges from $5,000, which many schools should be able to do in a one-year period, but some of the schools are over $50,000. And given the tightness of things, we would encourage at least a two-year transition there. Page 17, line 17, 28, 29, the $400, once the facilities are paid off, we appreciate that the legislation has added that kind of deferred maintenance piece, because that was something we recommended earlier. We do have questions about the amount, whether that is sufficient to do deferred maintenance, and we'll have some recommendations about that. On page 19, again, lines 19 to 19A through 27. Again, we would, do you have to do this every year, provide this information, or when you apply for the building transition aid? So that's a question there. On page 23, with regard to consideration of the authority, the requirements for, in terms of subdivision 5, point number 1, lines 23 to 16 through 19, we would oppose tying it directly to the current system of test scores, which are comparing one grade from another grade, a class. And if there is going to be some academic, it should be on the growth of individual students so that we see that the school is actually making progress in terms of individual kids, not one grade class of second graders versus another grade of class of second graders. But we have some serious concerns about that. The other thing in terms of line 23-22, the discussion you had about financial statements and positive fund balance, our recommendation there would be to just say that the school has to give financial statements for the last 5 years to the authority and allow the authority to look. If it's $1,000 they were off in terms of positive fund balance, is that the big issue? And I think to leave some room to the authority to make the determination is probably a better way of looking at that. On page 24, again, the issue of 24-24 to 24-16, that whole issue of academic scores, which is different from the other page, we have some concerns about. On page 26, one of the concerns we have is the cap of $150 million.
Mr. Chair, could I have him go back to page 24 and
point out? If you could just point out on 24.
Thank you.
24.6 is different than what is on page 23-16 through 19.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, we have concerns about that whole issue, but okay. We do believe whatever is going to be in the bill should be consistent in language.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Nolan.
I think that's a good point. Regardless of what members decide to do there, though, I think the intent of the author was for those two to be parallel. I don't think that it was to imply a different academic performance measure on one versus the other.
We're just pointing that out.
Great. Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
As I mentioned on page 26, we do have concern about the total, the cap on debt obligation. As charter schools continue to grow, if all the bonding authority is used up, what happens there? On page 27, lines 27-5 and beyond, we're not sure why. If the bonds are issued through the Commissioner of Management Budget, why the school would not inform that commissioner of potential default rather than the Department of Education, but it's just a minor thing. In terms of then on page 32, I think one of the issues that has seems to be a constant confusion is this affiliated building company and whether or not there's been a definition of it. An affiliated building company is defined by the IRS under tax status. And that's why last year the language, and it is here, that affiliated building company has to meet the regulations of IRS because they determine whether something is an affiliated or subsidiary company to another corporation. So it's already in federal law what the definition is, and I think that has been, a concern that we've seen in trying to, as people have tried to come up with this list of schools that have affiliated building companies, because we got to go to the federal statute to define that, not state statute. In terms of startup aid, we have no problem with using 1 year of startup aid for setting up this system. We do oppose the elimination of startup aid after the year 2013.
All right, Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Mr. Piccolo, I just wanted to go back to your questions on page 23 and 24 with respect to the academic requirements that are in the bill for being considered to get into a building. If that language was changed to reflect, for example, some kind of performance, satisfactory performance of the charter that the school may have, would that kind of criteria be satisfactory? Or I understand the point Senator Salzman is making. I don't necessarily disagree with that, that I think we ought to make sure all schools are performing well, and if, particularly if we're going to continue to invest in them. So I'm not necessarily opposed to that. But I know some charters are taking as a challenge to educate students that may not be performing very well, and their objective is to get them to grade level or to get them to show some growth, and they may not qualify under this, but they may be doing things very successfully. So my question is, if that were changed to be something that would reflect the mission they have defined and the performance standards they've defined in the charter, would that be satisfactory to you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, yes, because in the charter contract, every school has to set academic goals. And so if they're meeting their academic goals, their authorizer normally will renew their school. If they are not, that is grounds for closing the school down. So, yes, we would be open to that and supportive of that.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much for your succinct testimony and points. Appreciate it.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Dr. Terry Tofty, is it Tofty? Okay, thank you. Please join us, and we have several others too, so we're hoping to get everybody in before 11 o'clock.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I take that as encouragement to be succinct.
Succinct. Please give your name for the record, please. Thank
Terry
you.
Tofty. I'm the Executive Director for Finance and Development for the St. Paul Conservatory for Performing Artists. And in the interest of full disclosure, prior to that, I was superintendent of schools in Northfield. I worked with Senator Dahl. He was a teacher there for whose performance I was fully accountable, which explains the gray hair. I am not here to talk about the detail, the technical pieces. I've enjoyed the discussion, and there's lots of questions to be resolved. But my interest here is in Senator Salzman's effort to improve the current circumstances under which charter schools operate. Now, when I was in college, I was a chemistry major until halfway through my junior year up at Concordia in Moorhead. And I decided to switch to philosophy. And I had to go and tell my advisor that, whose name was Dr. Osterkamp, a rather stern fellow. And he at that time, you could smoke your pipe in your office in colleges, which dates me. And he leaned back and puffed on his pipe, and he said, Terry, you have to decide whether you want to be useful or thoughtful. And I became a school administrator and managed to be neither. But what I'm trying to come at today is from more of a thoughtful perspective, not so much the detail, and all of which is extremely important. But there's a couple of things about the current situation that I think are troubling, that Senator Salzman has made a valiant and courageous effort to address. Not work for the faint of heart. As this hearing has held forth to be true. I think one of the things that is a reality, I've worked on the traditional side most of my career. I've been in education for 38 years, and for 33 of those years I worked on the traditional side. So I understand very much the perspective of people in the traditional school community and also the perspective of people working in the charter community. I think one of the things that's most troubling about working in the charter community is the isolation within which you operate. There are not many structures available to support people who essentially have to play six, seven, eight different roles themselves that are played by 10, 20, 30, 40, 100 people in a traditional school district. And the level of expertise required to competently manage a charter school is overwhelming. So if you have a bill before you that creates a facilities authority that on the one hand puts something in place that I think is, from the public perspective, more legitimate than what we currently have in place, and secondly, provides charter school leadership with extraordinarily competent resources to help them work their way through the business of funding and building a school, I think that's an enormous step forward. My colleagues in this field, they're courageous people, but it's very, very difficult to have all of the expertise in all the areas in one person. To have a resource to go to, I think, would be an excellent step forward. Secondly, the approval process. The current process, and I have great respect for people in the Department of Education, and the folks we work with are absolutely wonderful, but they go through a very a checklist sort of a process. They do their job as they're expected to do it. But what they don't have, I don't think, is a real clarity in terms of what the standards should be for the approval of a lease, nor do they provide technical assistance to schools as they negotiate leases. I know of a number of schools, having worked with Bob Wadle on with schools in their contract renewal year and getting in and digging and seeing what's going on there, a number of very good schools run by very good people who have absolutely crippling leases when it comes to the drain on their general fund resources to support the facility that they have in which to operate their school. And technical assistance in that area coming from very competent people in the Department of Education, I think would be extremely helpful. And finally, I think, you know, as a charter school administrator, coming in, having worked as a principal in Minnetonka, an assistant superintendent in 196 in Edina, and a superintendent, it was quite overwhelming with that background to take on everything that you have to take on as a leader. And as Senator Dahl knows, humility doesn't come easily for me, but I've discovered it. And I really think that the charter school community generally needs a dose of humility and should be reaching out to people like Senator Salzman who are trying to support their success in working with students in Minnesota. Finally, I believe the charter school should be held to a higher standard. That's why we were created. And I see nothing wrong with expecting performance. I see nothing wrong with expecting to be fiscally viable. You're not doing students a lot of good if you create a great school that collapses under its own weight in a year or two. And so to expect performance to meet or exceed state averages, I think, is reasonable and should be encouraged. And secondly, fiscal viability is a mix of appeal of the school to a student population and the responsible management of that school. And I think those are two important measures for whether or not a charter school should be allowed to continue to operate or, in the particular case of this bill, build a building and become a permanent fixture in public education in the state. And, you know, so in conclusion, I would say that from just a common sense perspective, and I'm just speaking for myself, it would be good to do some things with the charter school movement to create some conditions and standards that would serve to shrink this bridge or gap between the traditional schools and the charter schools, because there's a lot of resentment in the traditional on the traditional school side for authority and opportunities that charter schools have that the traditional schools don't, and also some perceptions that maybe that those opportunities and that authority are being abused. So anything that can be done to tie that down and to make this whole business more transparent with more support for charter school leaders, I think, is a great step forward, the detail of which I'll leave to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your comments and humor. So, Senator Hand.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you. Are you a doctor?
Not a real doctor. I have a PhD.
Well, doctor, that's a doctor to me, so I appreciate that. Your comment about, you said at the end of your testimony that you think it's appropriate that charter schools be held to a higher standard. And I'd like you to explain that because they are public schools, and we have a huge investment in the traditional public schools. And are you saying by that that the traditional public schools ought to be held to lower standards?
No, I think we all should be held to a higher standard. Senator, I agree. But I was speaking specifically to the language in the legislation, and I think I don't think it's a service to students in the state of Minnesota or to the state generally to create schools that are essentially duplicates of the ones that we currently have that aren't working. So in the charter school movement, if you're going to be given this wonderful opportunity that the state gives you and fully funds, you should be providing service that is enhanced for the student population you're serving.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you know, part of what went on with the creation of the charter school movement was recognizing that we don't have all of the answers for reasons that children aren't performing, and that it would give another opportunity without tying their hands to do that for people who just might have those. They might come out, and I think their initial plan was that many of those people that would lead that were currently in our public system but feeling restrained and could have a way out of it and the freedom to create that. So I'm just a tad puzzled by your last statement of wanting to somehow kind of rein in and put more structure around as if we could do that. Well, I mean, we can, but it isn't always the wisest what we do, and it may get in the way of accomplishing the result that is desired, versus loosening up on the public system and letting them have more freedom to do it. I'm not sure what you're actually saying to us.
Well, that's an excellent question, and I think I would clarify, where you need to be loose and where you need to be tight. On the finance side, in charter schools, your obligations are essentially identical to the traditional side. There's no point in being creative there. Where your creativity needs to come to bear needs to be in the area of program. And so where we need to tighten down and provide more support to schools, I think, is on the financial end of the operation. But for gosh sakes, don't restrict what we're trying to do on the program side.
Thank you.
Hey, is it Lynn Peterson? Okay. Mr. Peterson? Or?
Sure.
Ms. Peterson. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the community committee, thank you for the opportunity to allow us to speak today. My name is Lynn Gluck Peterson, and I'm the executive director of Clone Academy. Clone is a small town located about 10 miles west of Chaska, population about 1,500 people. Clone Academy is a charter school that serves students in kindergarten through sixth grade, and we're adding a grade level each year for the next 2 years until we reach eighth grade. This is our second year of existence. Last year we had about 130 students. This year we have 180, and next year we're looking at enrollment at about 230 students. I want to tell you a little bit about our landlord and our lease situation and how we'll be impacted by this legislation if it should pass. And I'm specifically talking about subdivision 17A. Our landlord is Hans Hagen.
Excuse me, Ms. Peterson. When you say subdivision, 17. Could you just reference a page?
Sure, page 12.
There's a lot of subdivisions.
It's on 15.29, Mr. Chair. Oh, excuse me. No. Is that it?
Section 6.
Okay. Section 6, subdivision 7. Is it page 12?
Bottom of page 12.
Page 11 and 12, okay.
It starts on the bottom of page 11. Our landlord is Hans Hagen of Partnership for Better Education. Hans Hagen is the owner of Hans Hagen Homes, a real estate developer. He is also a wonderful friend to our school. When we were first considering starting a charter school, there were not any buildings in our community that met the requirements of E1 classification. Hans Hagen built the school for us. He started a new company, which owns the building and now leases the facility to our school. Hans was required by his lender to set up a separate corporation in order to receive payments. Our lease is based on student enrollment, but it has minimum and maximum rent due per year. During the first 3 to 4 years of our lease, our school is paying less for space than Hans Hagen is paying for his mortgage on the building that we lease. In later years, Hans will make up the loss over time, and as our school grows, assuming our school grows, which he hopes to make up for that loss, or which he hopes that our school does grow. And while it may seem strange that Hans was willing to take a loss on our building for the first few years, if you know Hans Hagen at all, you know that this is not strange. He supports public education. He supports charter schools as a public education choice, and he supports the community of Cologne. As you might be thinking that perhaps he was willing to take a lower rent now so that he could earn tons of money later from us, but that isn't the case either. While our rent does go up as our student population increases, our lease has a maximum rent lease, a cap on what we pay for the lease. And when we reach that cap, our cost per square foot is still a fair market value for an E1 rated building in our community. We feel very fortunate to have a friend like Hans Hagen, and we feel very comfortable with our facility and our lease cost, knowing that we are able to get a good value for our students, our families, and the tax dollars that support our school. This proposed legislation will prohibit us from having a lease with Partnership for a Better Education, and it will prevent us from being eligible for lease aid. Without lease aid, we will not have the funds we need to run our program. The thought of displacing over 200 students and their families who have put so much time and talent and value in education is very disheartening, to say the least. I understand that the intent of this legislation was to eliminate building companies and to find a way for charter schools to own buildings. But this bill does a lot of other things, too. And while I know that many changes have been made to try to address the needs of the charter school community, the bill is too complex to have been fully reviewed and to have every potential problem corrected in the short period of time since it was introduced. I sincerely hope that you consider holding off this bill until the next legislative session so that ample time can be given to studying this bill and finding ways to overcome the potential downfalls. Again, I appreciate your time and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Peterson. Senator Salzman.
On these points, Mr. Chair, I just want to note that I appreciate the testimony today, Ms. Peterson, and I don't believe you contacted me until last night at about 5 o'clock. And so we have really reached out to many schools to ask for situations that are before them. I think that's why we've continued to, you know, to work on this list. And so I appreciate this, but I really wish we would have had this conversation before today. And that's why I think that we certainly have some opportunities to address some of these issues, but there have been many invitations to the charter school community to come forward with these situations before today.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Peterson. Nancy Schultz. Welcome.
Mr. Chair.
Please give your name for the
record. I'm Nancy Schultz. I work for Academy of Sciences and Agriculture. I'm their business manager, senators. And some history. I did work at the Department of Education. I did the lease aid applications for 3 years. I was part of the lease aid task force to make lease aid application actually faster and more to review and get them out and the money back to the charter schools faster. When I look at this, I do have a couple of comments. I believe the whole facilities aid, taking the deduction from general education aid instead of just making it a aid appropriation would be a lot easier. Also, the if you get bonding authority, you get 84% of the bond. and then you take 6% of your operating capital and you have to push that aside, and you have to take $100 of your operating capital and put that into a reserve fund for maintenance of your building. So that leaves you with about 72% of your dollars to fund your building. And I did have a question on if you were approved for your building and the max is 1120 and your student enrollment went down, would you still get the appropriation that the bonding authority did, or would they do an adjustment on 1120? Because we would actually get more money if our student enrollment went down, if they still gave us our bond payment in the 1120. So now it's a formula based on student population or a percentage. And if you just took 1120 out of Gen Ed and our bond payment was, let's say, $800,000 a year, and we only got $200,000 deducted from Gen Ed, we would make money. Is that the intent? Am I right there, Tom? So, and then
maybe we could have Dr. Melcher to.
Do you see where I'm going with that?
Yeah.
Whoops. I'm a business manager, so I'm a numbers person.
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. My understanding of the way the language is drafted is that the facilities aid would be 100% of the principal and interest, and that basically ensures the bondholders that they're going to, that the lease.
Or get paid.
But the adjustment to general education aid is the difference between that amount and the $1,120 times the pupil units of the school. So if the pupil units for the school go down, that would increase the gap between the principal and interest that's being paid through facilities aid, and so it would increase the size of the deduction in general education. So the charter school wouldn't be making any money on that. What they would be seeing
it
is a larger cross-subsidy coming off of the general education aid, which is really the same thing that happens now. It's just more transparent because they're going to get the money that they need to make the principal and interest, but it's going to take a deeper reduction out of general education aid, which is indirectly what happens now if you're capped. It's just more direct.
The language is very confusing. It's very confusing in how that's going to work. My we do have an affiliated building company. Mine is, can we take our building company with the transition aid until maturity, or will a call date become due to us?
Senator Saltzman?
That's disappeared in here now.
On that point, Mr. Chair, I'd like Mr. Nauman to address that, because this was an area where we, I think, made some significant changes, is that in the prior bill, there was
Please no whistling in
like
here.
A mandate, essentially, like, you know, a requirement that these schools would then transition, and that has a lot greater flexibility now. So, Mr. Now, maybe you could address the fact that our schools required, so that if a school currently has an ABC and would be able to qualify for the transition aid.
Oh, crickets either.
Would they have to transition to the facility aid program?
Mr. Chairman and members, if I heard the testimony correctly, we're talking about the Agriculture and Food Sciences Academy. Is that
mm-hmm.
correct? So that school is on line 31.21 and
right.
is clearly listed as a school in transition.
Mm-hmm.
If you are a school that's eligible for transition aid and you are a school that has that you are receiving above the cap, that cap, the grandfather provision will continue until the bonds are paid off, or if you convert to facilities aid by going through the endorsement process, then you would live under a lower cap amount. Senator Saltzman, am I getting at your question?
Senator Saltzman.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Nauman, I believe that right now the Ag and Food Sciences Academy is getting $1,369
mm-hmm.
in lease aid, and it's my understanding they would continue to get that in transition aid until they chose to seek being endorsed by the charter school authority, and then they would operate under those funding parameters.
So Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chairman, that is a choice for those schools to choose either route, depending on as to which is more advantageous to them?
Senator Saltzman, the answer, is that correct?
Yes, it is. Okay. Yes, all correct.
Right. On page 20.
Ms. Schultz?
Mr. Chair, on page 24, there is a determination that I don't know if they'll consider call date when we're applying for transition aid or not. It's on lines 24, 31, 32.
Mr. Chairman, and members, what's happening there is that the authority is determined, is required to make a determination. And under that process, it evaluates a variety of conditions. If you're a school that's in transition, as I discussed before, it makes sense to for a transition school to work with the authority to have the call dates and the potential economic conditions at the time in which that transition from transition to facilities aid is made. So, for example, if you have one interest rate on your bonds and the economic conditions in the future deteriorate and the bond rates are not quite as lucrative or as cheap, you may not want to make that transition. So there's some back and forth, and economic conditions are considered, and that's what that language is doing at that point.
Thank
so
you.
The potential exists that a charter school would stay in transition. I know that we've got at least a charter school or two that have gotten an interest rate right now at about 5%. It would
that's
be hard to
school.
Beat that. So that's why that language was added for
right.
that purpose.
So transition aid would go for another 20 years? I mean, those are maturity dates in some of these schools.
Mr. Chairman and Senators, you'll note that when we established the transition aid, it originally had a date. And the idea, obviously, is to move to a system where you've got charter schools in one of two buckets. You're either getting lease aid or you're getting facilities aid. But I think it was felt that it was a little too hard to make that transition that quickly. So conceivably, yeah, it'll have to continue for a fair bit of time.
Thank you.
Okay.
One more thing.
Sure. Ms. Schultz?
I do like to say I do like the $400 for the improvement at the end of when your building is paid for. That's a nice language in there.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Is Amber Reichgott here?
She was here.
Maybe not.
She was here.
She was.
She had to leave, Mr. Chair. She has a she had a 9:30 meeting, but she
okay.
is following this very closely and has submitted a letter of support in favor of the bill.
Okay. Is Scott Krumquist here?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee member Scott Krumquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. I want to join in adding our thanks to Senator Saltzman for her incredible work, both last session and this session, really in reforming our charter school laws. I think she's been very successful in bringing attention to some much-needed areas of reform. We really support the vast majority of this bill. In fact, I really couldn't point to specific provisions that we oppose, but I do want to raise more concern about an overall uneven playing field that may be created. As you're aware, in the area of facilities, we already have an uneven playing field. We have about two dozen districts in the state that have access to a program called the Alternative Facilities Program. The rest of the school districts do not have that similar access, and they really struggle with trying to meet their facilities needs. And, in fact, they're really left with, I believe, Mr. Nauman, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's $65 per pupil for deferred maintenance. And they access that through an equalized levy. Under this proposal, the charter schools would be realizing a $400 per pupil in state aid to address deferred maintenance issues. So we worry about that. You know, the reality is that traditional school districts, by and large, need to go to the voters to pass a referendum to construct a new building or to do significant renovations. So we think if you do move forward on this, it's an issue we're going to have to address in the future in terms of addressing the facilities needs of our traditional schools. Senator Wieger chaired a task force, I think it was 10 years ago, on facilities. 12 years ago. Thank you.
Thank you.
That task force found that there were, I think, over $4 billion in unmet facilities needs among our traditional public schools. and we really have made very little progress in those 12 years in addressing those. So, again, I want to thank Senator Salzman. I think she's done great work. It brings forward a lot of issues that really needed to be addressed, but we do just have to go on the record expressing our concern about that overall issue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Kronquist. Is there anyone else that would like to address? Please give your name for the record, and we have about 2 minutes.
I'll take just the 2 minutes. I'm John Cairns. I'm an attorney and lobbyist for the charter school industry. I've probably represented nearly 100 of the schools in Minnesota since the day that Ms. Reich got. I'm sorry she left because she was a great ally of charter schools, and Mr. Nathan is here, and the three of us probably were there at the beginning. Some of you may have been as well. I want to raise two questions on the points raised earlier on section lines 11.31, section 6. And Senator Roebling, I can explain why I think Senator Roebling's hypothetical is, in fact, affected by this section, but I'll do that by email later. I think this language still needs a lot of work, and I've negotiated probably 75 leases for charter schools, not all here in Minnesota, but most in Minnesota. The transition aid in Section C, I think, is fine, and that does cover the so-called bonded schools that are listed later in the document. For the schools you've heard about, Cologne and the two Charter School Development Corporation schools, that's Yinghua Academy and Hiawatha Leadership in Minneapolis, both could be solved, that problem, by putting them on the list, the pre-endorsed list at the end, and putting them into transition aid. So I think that's a fairly easy solution on those three. But I do believe this language here still puts at risk just about every other charter school lease in the state, either for being simply voided or loss of lease aid. And for schools to lose lease aid, Mr. Piccolo pointed out the loss on the grandfather rights, which I also think is not a correct thing to do, but that's another point. This language needs a lot more work as to schools that are not on the transition list. I think the problem is the data to figure out which ones they are is not easy to find because you almost have to read every lease to understand it. But no landlord, including a church, another nonprofit, or a for-profit, uses rent except to pay operating costs of the building, which includes tenant improvements, and to pay the purchase money mortgage for the building. Even if it's been converted from an office space, the conversion is for the primary purpose of being available to a charter school. So I'm not saying, Senator Salzman, we can't solve that problem with some language changes, but I do think it imperils just about every lease that doesn't fit building transition aid. My last comment is this on the charter school authority. I think you properly give them wide range of authority to make economic decisions to issue bonds later for charter schools, and if it's cost effective for the school and reduces the state lease aid, they'll certainly do that. With that in mind, I think it really is a mistake to put in the bill now an artificial limit of 20 years, for example, on the bonds. Let the authority make that decision, and likewise on the cap. And additionally, on the 20-year language is now written, it starts not with the year the charter school bonds are issued, but the year that the original bonds were issued. And under that circumstance, 20 years will not permit any transaction to occur. I'd leave it to the authority to decide what the limit should be. And quite frankly, I think there'll be more than 20 years in order to get your goal, which is proper, of less leasing and less cost to the charter school. Those are perfectly appropriate goals. Lastly, I'll say this. I think we could, even under the current circumstances, with a little bit of work, transfer title to the charter schools even today for the bonded schools. There's some things that would have to be done with that with all the other parties involved and the bondholders. But if today it's clear that charter schools can own real estate, I'm not entirely clear that it is, I'm not so sure we couldn't actually transfer title under the current bonds to the charter school. But that's perhaps for another day here. I don't think that's a legislative concern.
Is your concern on the 20 years that the bonds are going to be hard to sell, or that what's the issue with the 20-year bonds?
Mr. Chairman and members, the length of bonds and the term of bonds, interest rates and others, is really a market condition for everybody in the state, senior citizen homes, school districts, cities, nursing homes. It's all a function of what the market then will take and permit versus what you can afford to pay.
Right.
And, for example, when you deal with state funding for nursing homes and the healthcare system, you may increase or decrease their capacity to pay the debt service under a bond issue. Okay. the market will adjust for that. So my point is simply let the authority decide the length of the bonds, because that's an essential part of the economic package to get the bonds sold in the first place, and the bonds should be marketable. That's my point. I think the bonds should be marketable.
I think maybe the question ought to be directed toward management and budget, because I think most of the bonds that we sell right now as general obligation bonds are 20-year bonds, and maybe that's where the 20 years came from. On the issue of the cap, I'm not so worried about, because, you know, as we get close to caps, whether it's the Higher Education Authority cap or some housing cap or whatever the cap might be, and we have a lot of different funds, we just generally raise the cap.
Mr. Chairman, and members, I don't doubt that. I think that's probably the case.
Is management and budget here? If you could just maybe comment on the 20-year and what, you know, where that decision came from.
Sure. Mr. Chair, my name is Christy Swanson with Minnesota Management and Budget. Management and Budget is bound by the Constitution to limit general obligation bonds to 20 years, and we propose that same limit to charter schools.
Okay.
Sure. That is a concern. Well, a 30-year bond is a concern for the...
But the Constitution doesn't control. These are not general obligation bonds.
Right. That's the point, Your Honor.
And I think that's the issue that Mr. Kearns is talking about. So was it on the part of management and budget's decision to suggest 20 years that they thought they were general obligation bonds, or that they were actually thought that we should stay with 20-year bonds because they're the ones we use for general obligation bonds are 20 years?
Correct. We are aware of the type of bonds being proposed, and we suggest a 20-year limit.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kearns, you confused me a bit with your statement that it wasn't a legislative concern regarding the transfer of bonds to the bond holding to the school or the ownership, but yet we right now prohibit them from owning it. So how can that not be a legislative concern?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I don't believe I intended to say that. All of this is a legislative concern, properly so. These are public dollars. The point I'm making is that if it's clear charter schools can own property, we may be able to deal with title issues under the current bonds. And back to your point, Senator, Mr. Chairman, these are revenue bonds. And if they were GO bonds, I'd have no problem with 20 years. I would agree with that. These are revenue bonds. They're all 30 years right now. I don't see any way in which the charter school authority can issue 20-year bonds. And in some cases, the way the language is written now, they'd be 12, 13, 14-year bonds, maybe even less, depending on when the charter school opted to come into the program.
Sure. And I think this is an appropriate issue that will come up in the Finance Committee when we get there. And so, members, we are under call, but let me just ask Senate staff. It looks like there's a number of issues that still need to be talked about, and Senator Saltzman.
Yes, I agree, Mr. Chair.
It might be my recommendation that we would lay this on the table, and maybe a week from now, if you would have time to talk to different people about some of the issues that came up, and if anyone else has concerns, that you would be able to look this over, and then we'd bring it back. I'd like to see, because this is a very technical bill and everything, I'd like to see it well put together before it would go to, we'd send it out. So see heads nodding. So, Senator Saltzman, you want to?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the A-18 amendment as amended. Is that how I would do it?
Yes, and lay it on the table.
And lay it on the table.
Good.
At this time.
All right. Senator Saltzman moves the Senate File 2716 A-18 amendment as amended to be laid on the table. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you very, very much, members, and all the people who testified and put work into it. Committee is adjourned.